Hi, I'm Melanie, and this is Dream Chasers, the podcast where I talk to inspirational Australians about their journeys across the globe to follow their dreams. They're doing big, big things in the big, big smoke. So sit back and join me as I share their trials, their tribulations, and their highest moments. It's an awesome ride. Today on the Dream Chasers podcast, I have Deborah Riley. Deborah is one of the world's most well-known production designers on film and television. She has worked on blockbuster films such as The Matrix, the sci-fi film starring Keanu Reeves, and period drama Anna and the King starring Jodie Foster. Then there was Baz Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge, the musical. Today, Deb is better known for the smash hit TV show Game of Thrones, the dragon-filled TV set that millions of fans around the world know as Westeros. Deb, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, you're welcome, Melanie. Good morning.
Quite a life full of achievement.
It sounds good in retrospect, but at the time I was just trying to scuffle up some sort of career like anyone else.
Let's go back to the beginning because you were born in Brisbane, a capital city in Australia's sunny subtropics. Can you tell us about growing up in Brisbane in the 70s, what that looked and felt like?
I was raised in the northern suburbs of Brisbane. It wasn't exactly Pleasant Valley Sunday, but because it was such a new suburb, it was very aspirant. I was never told that we were any different to anybody else. I didn't really realise that there was any kind of, you know, working class or lower working class kind of bias out there. I had no idea. I just thought that you could grow up and do whatever you wanted. So I was always interested in art and that's what I followed.
Living in the northern suburbs, did you come from a family of creative people?
That was something I was very aware of. My mum would have loved to have lived in my generation. It would have been easier for a woman to follow exactly what she wanted to do. My father, he was far more creative than what his job allowed. They were two quite creative people, but they never had the opportunity to be able to express that. My mum was also born in London, and so to be in Australia felt very parochial to them. So it was, to me, like before I'd even been anywhere else, I always felt that I wanted to go somewhere else. And art, I guess, was one of the ways to do that and one of the ways in which you could explore other places and know that other artists existed. So for me, art was always something that represented a window somewhere else. But I had a very bad speech impediment when I was a kid. And so if I wanted to talk about a car, I had to draw a car. If I wanted to talk about a goat, I had to draw a goat. It was that difficult to understand me. So drawing had always been a way of communication as well. I was always very good at drawing, in particular, very good at copying. I could copy anything that was put in front of me. So I was considered a talented child. And that was my escape and my opening and my opportunity to be able to escape.
At this age, a child with an impediment and a prodigy at art, did you ever think that, you know, you'd work on TV shows?
No, I mean, I didn't grow up when I was a child thinking that I would work in television or film. I really had no idea, although I was interested in animation. I loved The Muppet Show. There were lots of things that I really enjoyed, but a kid from my part of Brisbane would have had no idea how to get there. For all I knew at the time, I would have been a painter. I really didn't have any idea of how it would make itself known or how it would fulfill itself. But it had to be central somehow to what I was going to do. But I really had no idea exactly in what format that would take. And when I finished school, I went into architecture, which was actually a really, really wonderful thing and ended up being very pivotal in the course of my career, but little did I know at the time that it would be.
And so speaking of architecture, This is interesting because you went and studied that at university with the intent to be an architect, but you've told the media before that it was Batman, the movie, that actually led you to Australia's Arts Academy, the National Institute of Dramatic Arts, in the 90s. So can you tell me about how it was Batman that actually launched you into that trajectory of performance and set design and NIDA?
It was something that happened when I was in my third year of architecture. Although I was enjoyed architecture and was good at architecture, I also knew in my heart of hearts that that wasn't where I needed to be. And there were people in the class who were much more inspired by it or naturally good at it than I was. When I went to the movies and saw Batman Returns, I remember just looking at the set design and for the first time thinking to myself, now who does that? And I went back to my old school and I looked up the career journals and, you know, there was no internet in those days, and saw that you could study set design and you could study it, you know, in a couple of places in Australia, but the name that I recognised was NIDA. And so I applied, and that was that, really. That was another one of those very sharp right-hand turns that my life took. And so when I went to NIDA in 1994, that was the start of what became a career in entertainment.
Yeah, and so NIDA is in Sydney. So yep. What was it like at the time meeting all these other artists and these creative people in the early 90s? You're sort of like walking around in black with a beret at that time, being all, you know, I'm an art student.
I was quite the opposite. I didn't look like an art student at all. I mean, I would have looked like an engineering student or something. Like, I really didn't go for that sense of creativity, and I don't think I do now. And I was told at the time by one of the teachers, he said something like, it doesn't matter what you look like, it's the contents of your head that's the most important part, because I really didn't fit in the usual sense. And I certainly wasn't the best in my class by a long shot. And I wasn't used to being in that, inverted commas, creative world, surrounded by artists and people who wanted to be artists. I always thought that to call yourself an artist is something that somebody else should call you. I've always felt very awkward about calling myself an artist. Like, I think that's a very, very, very high bar to refer to yourself as an artist. So I would never, even today, refer to myself as an artist. So, yeah, I came from a very conservative background, and it was the first time that I really began to understand just how conservative it was.
Yeah, okay, so it would have been a whole time of self-discovery for you.
Yeah, just trying to work out where I fitted in or if I fitted in. After my first year at NIDA, I very, very seriously considered leaving because I couldn't see a future for myself. I didn't know, as I say, I just didn't know where I fitted in or what I could offer. And it was very confusing. It was something that a lot of students talk about. It's not unusual to me that the first year of NIDA is very, very difficult and very challenging. And they are very good at trying to weed out who belongs there and who doesn't, who has what it takes and who should move on. So, you know, for a young person, and I hadn't even been overseas at this point. I mean, I think I'd been to New Zealand. I hadn't even travelled. And here I was trying to express, you know, all of these things through these plays that we were interpreting, but I really didn't have any clue what I was talking about. It's almost like I wish I could go back to NIDA as an older person because I would do it so much better.
Yeah, I know what you mean. What does it take to make it at NIDA when you say they weed them out?
It used to be quite notorious for constant assessment. We were there in the morning and then we would crew the shows at night. So very often we were there incredibly long days, leaving at 11 p.m. and back the next morning. So it was really tough. And the way that they've managed to create so many extraordinary graduates is because they're tough, and good on them, because the film industry and the entertainment industry is tough. You really need a lot of resilience and a lot of perseverance and determination in order to survive. And that was the first place that really illustrated that to me. And it was very challenging.
You did survive. You did graduate. So you were this fresh-faced graduate of the National Institute of Dramatic Arts in Sydney, full of optimism, living in Australia in your 20s, trying to make it doing sets for theatre and other things. What were some of the standout struggles or challenges of that time after NIDA?
it's quite hard to break into the industry, and all you can do is actually trust that it's out there somewhere. You have this kind of optimism, but at the same time, there's a lot of, you know, just practical things that nobody's ever mentioned to you. You know, how do you fill out a tax return when you're a freelance person? But the most daunting thing when you graduate is just the fact that you're not coddled anymore by an institution. Do you have what it takes to survive the troughs? You know, the ritual of working as in film or in theatre, I think, as a designer, is just that there's a lot of work that's unpaid. And that is tough because you think to yourself, you know, if I were a plumber, I would be paid. But for some reason, because of the way the arts industry works, somehow or other, it's acceptable to allow people to work for nothing. So that was the struggle. The work itself was never really a struggle, but just being able to pay the rent, that's the struggle. That's something that it can be really tricky and really daunting, and why a lot of people leave the industry.
Yeah, okay. And so the late 90s and the early 2000s, so this is where you actually had a string of successes that made you. And this started off with The Matrix. Like I said in my introduction, that starred Keanu Reeves. It was filmed in Sydney, mostly in Sydney. Then there was Anna and the King, filmed in Malaysia, I believe, that starred Jodie Foster, a period drama. And then there was Moulin Rouge, of course, Baz Luhrmann's epic musical. But can you tell us about The Matrix? Because that seems to be the moment you got the big break. So where were you and what were you doing when you scored that gig?
Australia at the time was quite a centre for filmmaking. Our dollar was low, and so there were a lot of American productions that were coming to our shores. And what that meant was that there weren't enough crew to fill all of those positions. But because I could draft and because I'd studied architecture, I was able to create construction drawings. So I was called in to have an interview with Michelle McGay, who still works in the industry today, and she was the art director. And, she sat down and had a look at my drawings and took me into the workshop, and I thought I was being asked to come and interview to draw up an opera or something like that, which was the kind of work that I'd been doing. And you know, I don't know, it could have been The Ring cycle for all I knew. I had no idea what it was. And she took me down into the workshop, and there was a big fiberglass helicopter hanging from the rafters. And I remember saying to her, "Michelle, what is this?" And she said, "It's a feature film, Deb." And I was sold. That was it. That was the moment that I thought, right, I've found my place. And, yeah, I never worked in theatre again after that. It was really an extraordinary moment that I remember very clearly.
What was it like being the girl from the northern suburbs from Brisbane on the sets of Hollywood blockbusters tasting success?
I don't really think at the time I felt like I was tasting success. I was just, you know, I was a crew member. You know, there's tons of us who obviously work behind the camera on these things. I was just really happy to be a part of it in any small way. At the time, I didn't particularly think that I would be a production designer. That seemed like something that would be very far off. But I was very good and very proud at producing the sets that I was given, and I took real pride in that. I liked the people of the Art Department of Film, because the wonderful thing about it is that there's a real understanding of the science and technology at the same time as being creative. So it's very right brain, left brain. And I felt like I found my home in that sense. And there were other people in the art department who had also studied architecture. We were a very similar group of people, and in a sense I found my tribe. And that for me was the most exciting thing, is that I knew I'd found my home. So when The Matrix led on to Anna and the King, I mean, that was the first time that I realised that you could see the world on someone else's dime, and that you were able to build you know, in all sorts of different cultures and all sorts of different time periods, that there was no limit to what we would be able to work on. And I just thought that all of this just rolled from one to the other to the other, and that, you know, when Moulin Rouge came, that was just the best thing ever, because Baz and Catherine had been trained at NIDA as well. So suddenly there were people with me who had come through the same school as I had, and they completely understood the way I was trained to think. And so that's where I finally thought, okay, right, I've found my place. This, like, by looking at them and by watching them and seeing how they worked and the discipline that they had, like their absolute work ethic, I understood where NIDA came into it. That was the moment that I realised that I had a place. So I have them to thank, really. And it was extraordinary. It was such a great thing to roll from film to film to film. I had no idea that it would come to an end and that the dollar would rise and the Americans would go away. But after that, I went on to work on the Sydney Olympic ceremonies, and I was one of the art directors of the ceremonies department. And that was extraordinary. I mean, how many 27-year-olds are able to art direct an Olympic ceremony? And, you know, it was, again, because we were Australian and there weren't any other people to do it. And so I was able to be offered a job that, you know, in any other country, had I've been born in England or America, I mean, that would have gone to a generation or two ahead of me. But because we were such a new country in so many ways and films and events of this scale were unheard of in Australia, there was an opportunity for people like me who were just hungry to be able to experience as much as they could. And I was very, very fortunate.
Yeah, I mean, that is fantastic at, you know, the age of 27 or thereabouts. Were you starstruck? Were you sort of rubbing shoulders with celebrities and feeling like you were overwhelmed with all this sort of glitz and glamour?
No, not at all. I mean, I mean, to this day, I don't rub shoulders with celebrities. I mean, I'm very proud of my position behind the camera, and that's where I live. The celebrity side of it doesn't remotely interest me, to be honest. But what I do love is that the work that we do is photographed, and it's part of a bigger thing. I love being part of a much bigger machine, and the celebrity aspect is part of that bigger machine, but it's not part of the, you know, where I function in that environment. So of course it's great when you see Jodie Foster walk in costume onto your set, or Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor are standing on top of your elephant. I mean, you know, it's thrilling, but it's not why I do it.
So you'd had this string of fantastic successes and you decided to move to LA. After that, though, you've told the ABC that your career went down in flames whilst in LA. This is before Game of Thrones. Can you tell me a little bit about that time in LA and the ups and downs?
Yeah, I didn't move to Los Angeles until 2008. So I was 35. Following the Sydney Olympics, I had worked with a production designer named Bridget Brock, the set decorator on Moulin Rouge, and she was a production designer in her own right working in Mexico. At the end of the Olympics, I went to see Bridget in Mexico, and the wonderful thing was is that she really took me under her wing and was able to share with me how to work on location, because I had worked very successfully, you know, building on stage. I'd built some wonderful sets on stage. Even in my tiny career, I'd built some wonderful things on stage. And I had, you know, worked on a grand scale on the Olympics, and I was understanding, you know, what art direction was. But I had never really worked on location. So she was the production designer for Alejandro González Iñárritu. You know, he went on to do The Revenant and Birdman and has a whole boatload of Academy Awards now. He was also planning a move to America. He had a film called 21 Grams. And so I worked as Bridget's art director on 21 Grams, and we were in the United States for that. And we finished that in 2002, 2003. And through Bridget, I had been able to have my first foray into the United States and what it would mean to work there and just what opportunities were there for people who worked in film. So that was a very big eye-opener for me, and we did another small film there called Real Women Have Curves, and that was in Los Angeles. So that was when I really understood that was where I needed to be geographically. When I came back to Australia when my father died, it was a long journey deciding to leave and deciding to put myself exactly where the work was, but it was also something that I knew I needed to do. So by the time I left for Los Angeles in 2008, I was making myself available, I guess, to whatever would happen next. It was one of those moments that was going to be sink or swim, and really thought that it would be a lot easier than it was. So when I say my career went down in flames, I just watched it disappear for years. I you know, thought to myself, you know, this is, it's so difficult. It wasn't that I necessarily couldn't find work, but there were all sorts of reasons why the work would go away. Actors drop out, or directors are fired, or the funding doesn't come through, or, you know, you're not approved by all the financiers. There's a million reasons why films can fall apart. And so you begin to understand just what a miracle it is that anything ever happens at all. And from 2008 to 2013, it was pretty grim. I had said to my mother that, you know, I can't be sitting here at 40. I just can't. It was soul destroying. I'd made a lot of good friends, and Los Angeles was full of people like me who were waiting for their big break and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, the money had long since run out, and, you know, it was time for me to go home. It wasn't the first time that the boxes were brought upstairs, and, you know, I had to kind of decide that 40 was going to be the limit of what I could physically and emotionally stand. It was taking a big toll on my mental health.
But after all this, things did turn around for you, and you did end up getting that, of course, position on Game of Thrones, working on the sets. Can you tell me about that moment?
I was down in Baton Rouge working on a ghostbusting film and received a phone call from my agent to say that I had the opportunity to interview for Game of Thrones. So that was extraordinary and entirely unexpected.
So let's talk about that, because, of course, Game of Thrones, for anybody out there that doesn't know, is the most popular show of our times. It's set in a fictional world called Westeros, based, of course, on a series of books, and it led you to an Emmy for Outstanding Production Design. When Game of Thrones first came on your radar, did you have any idea that it would be such a popular show?
So I joined Game of Thrones in 2013, so I got the first Emmy in 2014, and then I had four Emmys every year after that. I had an amazing run, and we were nominated every year that I was there. So I had gone from absolute obscurity to suddenly sort of enormous success. The show itself by season four was already popular. It was already something that people were watching, and it's interesting to think about now, because we would never have thought that it would become so, so big. But right from the start, it was very clear that it was very special. I think in Hamilton, there's a song that says, you know, I'm not going to waste my shot. Yeah, I felt exactly the same way. Like, that was my shot. And there was no way I was going to let that go. So I made the most of my time on that show. It was absolutely fantastic.
So obviously there's a lot of hysteria and secrecy around Game of Thrones and, you know, upcoming storylines when it was on and the sets. What was a key moment for you realising just how much public hysteria was surrounding the show, like as a set designer?
For me, it was very, very early in the piece. There was a website, or there still is a website, called Winter is Coming, I think, and they have all of these forums. And when it was announced that I was the new production designer, of course, everybody can look me up on IMDb and see what other shows I've done. And just the amount of hatred that was already coming through, people blogging about it, just saying, you know, who is she and what has she done? She's done nothing. You know, I hope this doesn't turn into a Baz Luhrmann show, you know, or whatever. It was really horrible. And I just remember thinking that the fact that people were prepared to write that about the production designer, I just can't even imagine any other show where people would even be aware of who the production designer was or what impact they might have on it. So that taught me a lesson just about social media and, you know, the interest that the show had.
Did that make you feel a lot of pressure in your working life on the show?
Yes. I mean, we always felt the pressure of, you know, living up to fan expectations. But it also just made me determined, because I just thought to myself, I mean, who are you? I mean, you don't know me. You don't know what I'm capable of. And so in many ways, it just made me even more determined to be successful, because there was absolutely no way I was going to let down David and Dan, our showrunners, or HBO. It's extraordinary to me that people are just allowed to have all of these opinions that they have absolutely nothing to back them up. And, so from my point of view, it kind of, as I say, it taught me a lesson very, very quickly. I just made sure that the work was nothing but anything that I could be completely proud of.
Yeah, and so Game of Thrones is shot around the world, including in Ireland, Iceland, Croatia and Spain. What's been your highlight of shooting in all those different locations?
So we were based in Northern Ireland, out of Belfast, so that was where the show was set up. That was where our studios were. We shot in the Titanic studios there, and then we shot on location in Croatia and in later seasons in Spain and in Iceland. Before me getting there, they had also shot in Malta. In post-production, they also did some scenes in Canada, and post-production was done in the United States. So there was an awful lot of work happening all around the world all the time on that show, and it was extraordinary. And for me, the best thing about the job was being able to visit it in these other locations. And I used to have something like 60 boarding passes a season, because you always had to fly Belfast, London, London, Spain, or London, Croatia, or whatever. And some days, I remember one day I flew to Spain just for the day. I flew out in the morning and back in the evening just to go and have a look at a set and make sure that it was going to fit where we needed it to fit and to come back. So for me, the highlight of the whole thing was the travel that we used to do. And there was one season in particular where myself and three of the producers went around Spain, and we must have gone in and out of every castle there was just to be sure of what was available to us and what the new season required, and to be able to make sure that we were able to always give the show the most spectacular locations that we possibly could. Those were some really, really special days, and I miss them greatly.
Yeah. Oh, wow. It's just so fantastic. And I mean, the locations are great to be shooting on, I'd imagine, but the sets themselves, I mean, they're fantastic. And there's the Land of Always Winter there. And then there's, you know, Casterly Rock. What's your favourite set that you've designed on the show?
Yeah. I mean, that was the great thing about the show, was that we were digging ourselves, you know, in and out of all these different worlds. And so as a designer, it was wonderful to be able to explore them all. In season four, there was a set called the Marine Audience Chamber. That was where Daenerys finds herself when she arrives in the Marine Audience Chamber. It's a huge moment for the character, and it was a huge moment for me as well, because that was where I think the new art department arrived. And as you can imagine, it was very nerve-wracking when I arrived on the show, because, you know, as just as those people, you know, in the blogging had pointed out, I wasn't very experienced, and I had a lot to prove. So it was on that set, I think, that everybody breathed a collective sigh of relief and realised I was going to be okay. So the Marine Audience Chamber is very special in that way. But from purely a design sense, I think the Dragonstone Audience Chamber from about, I think it was season seven, would have been my proudest moment in terms of just pure design.
It is just so great. And so you've had some really proud moments. As you've said, you've worked on these sets and you've won a number of Emmys. It's really great to achieve all those things. But do you want to do more? Is there something that, you know, career-wise that you would just love to do sometime now and or in the next 20 years or whatever?
It's a very strange thing, because when you win those awards and things, I've heard people say it before and I understand what they mean. It does something very strange to your brain, because somewhere you know that you obviously are very proud of these things, but it's never enough. There's always more. And so although we had won an Emmy for a previous season, it never stopped us working as hard as we possibly could to do the best work that we could for the next season. And so they kind of, in my brain, I don't even have the trophies like my mum has them. It's not about that so much. It's about what the next thing is. I'd love to be able to design in all different worlds, you know, whether it's something that's sci-fi, or, you know, a children's book, or, you know, a piece of architecture or an interior, or, you know, mentoring other students or whatever. It's about what's coming up that is always the most exciting. And you have to live like that. Like, you have to live really optimistically that the thing that you're doing next is going to be the best thing, and you know, you're going to enjoy that and the people and everything that that experience offers. But I don't have anything, any one thing in particular that drives me. It's more the opportunity to be able to, what the success of Game of Thrones has given me, I guess, is the opportunity to explore all different kinds of things and to have more control over what that is. So, yeah, I think I'm just enjoying the journey now. I'm not so stressed about just making ends meet. It's about, you know, enjoying it along the way and seeing where each thing leads. Because that's the thing. I mean, that's, you know, I'm still freelance, so you never really know.
Are there any tips that you have for young and upcoming artists that might be useful for them if they want to break into creative industries? What would you say was golden advice?
I think the best advice is just to really do your best. And at every opportunity you have, just say yes to the opportunities that come to you, and yes to what's presented, because you really don't know where they're going to lead. And enjoy it, you know, enjoy the people who are around you, and, you know, find the good people and stick with them. And that's the key. If you can find great people who do good work that you like, and, you know, you like working with them, and it's inspiring to you, then stick with it and work as hard as you can, because there's absolutely no limit to what can be achieved, but it also doesn't come for free. So you have to make sure that you're ready. And if you're prepared to put in the work, I promise you it will be rewarding.
Fantastic. Well, Deborah Riley, thank you very much for that fascinating discussion about your life and career trajectory today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Melanie. Thank you.
And that was Deborah Riley there that I was talking to today on Dream Chasers, the set designer from the epic television show Game of Thrones. Deb is a multi-Emmy award-winning set designer too. She's also worked on The Matrix and period drama Anna and the King, starring Jodie Foster. If you'd like to check out her work, give her a Google. She's done some fantastic visual scenes in these movies and television shows. And if you'd like to listen to other Dream Chasers and their stories on my podcast, please click on my other episodes. I've got entrepreneurs, actresses, singers, makeup artists, people that have achieved their dreams through lots and lots of hard work and taking risk. And if you'd like to check out my show in general, please find it on Apple Podcasts, Dream Chasers with Melanie Westbrook. You can also join the socials, Twitter and Instagram. You can also go to the Facebook group and join that one. It's a public group. That's Dream Chasers with Melanie Westbrook. I hope you're chasing your dreams today, and good luck. Thank you. Bye.